Support for WPR comes from Formagination on Madison's Capitol Square, a locally owned source for Wisconsin artisanal cheeses and gourmet gifts. More about custom catering and nationwide holiday shipping at Formagination.com.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, talking to start the program about the history of surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, UW-Madison. Our guests, we have two guests for you. One, Dr. Rebecca Minter with us. She's chair of the department and the first woman to hold that role. Dr. Minter's a leader in the field of surgery of the pancreas, the liver, and the gallbladder. Dr. Minter, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Dr. Michael Bentz with us as well. He is a professor in the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and he's a pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health. Dr. Bentz, thank you for joining in as well.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
As we talk with our two guests, we want to hear from you. Maybe you have some questions about surgery. What does it take to be a surgeon? Maybe how surgery has helped change your life. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Minter, I'll start with you. I understand the UW Department of Surgery is certainly one of the leading academic surgical programs in the nation. In your mind, what's behind the program's success?
Well, I came to UW in 2018, so I'm a relative newcomer compared to many of the people like Dr. Bentz and other colleagues who have been here for a long time. And I can tell you that I came here because of the people, and that's why I stay as well. I think that this department has really been built on the foundation of incredible talent, but also really collaborative thought leaders that have helped shape the discipline of surgery in both with respect to the clinical aspects of surgical care, but also in the field of research and bringing new innovation, new discovery, and really training what I believe are some of the most outstanding surgeons that leave here and go out into the world to take care of patients and spread really the brand of UW beyond our walls.
Somebody's already asking here, what is and isn't considered surgery?
That's a great question, because those lines have become blurred. And I think that, you know, within our department, we have 11 divisions across 11 different specialties. And our surgeons also do what some would call procedures. We have surgeons now who are able to do things through scopes that we previously would have to cut people open for. We collaborate with colleagues in other departments who do invasive procedures. And really, I think one of the things that makes UW great is we have tremendous partnership across departments and really try to get the best thing for a given patient and the least invasive and least harmful option for them.
You know what? Pam and Marshall's on board. And before I go to you, Dr. Bentz, let's go to Pam and Marshall. Pam, hi.
Hi, this is Pam, and I just wanted to first of all thank UW. 25 years ago, I had cancer of the uterus, and the health insurance company that I had didn't have anybody that could operate on a 422-pound woman, and UW had a plastic surgeon there that helped with that, and he did a fantastic job, and I was treated with utmost kindness and respect, and I've never forgotten that.
Oh, Pam, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Bentz?
Well, Pam,
you're both smiling, by the way. So,
well, Pam, first I would say thank you for calling. I'm not surprised our leadership and surgeons at that time worked to deliver a high level of clinical care like we do today. And I would say that 25 years later, I hope our patients now feel the same thing about their care, which is more commonly multidisciplinary. And I think that reflects the first question about what surgery or not. We have worked in much more collaborative fashion, particularly at our health system, to deliver solutions, working with other disciplines that are best for the patient, with high efficacy, high safety, and best outcomes. And I think that's very different in medicine now, perhaps, than 30 years ago or 40 years ago, where a lot of medicine and surgery happened in silos. Now, across health systems, people working together for kind of novel, creative, and highly successful solutions to challenging problems.
Yeah. Pam, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And you could join in too at 800-642-1234. Well, it's the 100th anniversary, and that means the department's been around since 1924. Can you give us a picture of what the department was like in 1924?
Well, we can share what we know. Neither Dr. Benz nor I were here in 1924. No. You know, 1924 was really when the School of Medicine transitioned from being a two-year medical school to a four-year medical school. And at that time, they created two departments, two clinical departments, the Department of Medicine and the Department of Surgery. And so at that time, it was all things surgery, including things like neurosurgery, orthopedics, urology, all the disciplines of surgery. And there were only three faculty, three full-time faculty who were paid $8,000 a year. So looked very different. They took care of patients in the community and also trained residents. And really, I would say education was the primary focus at that time. But even in the early days, the early seeds of research and innovation began to take hold. So Wisconsin General Hospital was the hospital that was then built that they practiced in. And then, you know, 45 years ago or 55 years ago, we moved to the hospital facility that we're in today. So it looks a lot different now with 170 surgeons just in the Department of Surgery and six surgical departments. So a lot has changed.
How have medical surgical ethics changed over time? You're probably still holding to some, you know, basic tenets that have been around forever, but how have things changed?
Well, I think, and Dr. Benz can comment as well, I think that the things that haven't changed, importantly, is that the patient is always at the center of what we do, whether that is caring for their condition, their disease, their trauma, or training the next generation or research, it always comes back to the patient. And in surgery, I think it's in all of medicine, but I think it really comes home in surgery of, you know, first do no harm. So I think that has not changed, and that's always at the heart of what we do. I think what's changed in medicine more broadly, and what we are actually a leader in the world, really through work that some of our surgeons have led, Dr. Schwarzy and others, is that medicine overall has become less paternalistic. You know, it used to be we would tell you what needed to be done, and then that would be the end of the conversation. That is no longer appropriate or the way that we practice. So it's really around shared decision-making, understanding what a patient's given goals are and what's most important to them, and then making sure that whatever treatment we offer hopefully helps them achieve those goals. And that's really different over the last 100 years, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's got a huge change. Tom in Minocqua has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. First of all, thanks to these doctors and all doctors who offer care. It's becoming harder and harder to find doctors, and so we're ever more grateful for what they do and their commitment to this. My question has to do with medical students. At what stage in their journey through medical school did they decide to specialize in surgery, and how do you begin to learn how to perform surgery, because there isn't much of a margin for error in surgery, I would think.
So where in the process of med school does someone choose to study surgery? And then how does the person learn? I think was what Tom from Minocqua was asking.
So it can be a complex evolution to the decision to be a surgeon, or for some people it's intuitive and they know all along what they want to do. In general, the first several years of medical school or general medical education interspersed with some clinical experience, so you begin to see what the possibilities are in a health science career in medicine. The third year of medical school into the fourth year are very specific clinical rotations where the students rotate with the various services across the medical school, which at this point is 17 different departments. And then into their last year of medical school, they refine their choices and then enter a match process where they determine where they're going to train in whatever their selected residency is. In the kind of a previous, most common previous model, people would complete a primary residency, commonly in general surgery, and then move on to 2 or 3 year residencies in a subspecialty before doing a year of fellowship training in a very specific area and then enter practice. Now, many subspecialties will match students for an extended residency right out of medical school for 6, 7, or even 8 years, so they can focus on this one area, given the large amount of material there is to learn. People still add on fellowship training for a year or two, or even research for those academically inclined. And so the training after medical school can be 10 years in a non-extreme circumstance. So many surgeons don't have their first job till they're 35 years old. And they've been in training that length of time to hone their skills and learn their craft.
Yeah. I was thinking as you were talking, I said, I wonder how soon they're ready for retirement by the time they're finished with the. But I imagine that that education never quits.
It's lifelong. There's no doubt about it. And we always tell our trainees the scariest year of all of your training is the first year in practice. When suddenly the buck stops with you.
Oh, well, I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about some of the achievements. You know, I was reading up a bit on, and, you know, sort of some jaw-dropping things that have been developed within surgery here. One of the world's first anesthesiology units was established at UW. It'd be interesting. Talk a bit about the history of anesthesiology as it pertains to surgery.
It is a great, it's a great question. And I would say I will be sharing what I know from reading about that history, because the anesthesiology, it is one of the oldest anesthesiology departments in the country, if not perhaps the first, and was initially in surgery, but split out long ago. Has been a separate freestanding department for a long time. Interestingly, though, I am the first woman to be the chair of the department, and we have almost 50% of our faculty are women now, which is very, very unusual across the country. That was not always the case, and there was actually a young student who had wanted to be a surgeon but wasn't a very welcoming field in her day named Virginia Apgar, who came here instead to become an anesthesiologist. And those of you who have had children will know the Apgar score when a baby is born. And so that's part of our history as well, of really a rich history of early innovation and development of the field of anesthesiology here at UW.
You know, one of the scariest moments of my early childhood, this is a little different area here. When I was just a little kid, my aunt took me to a hospital to visit a friend who was in an iron lung with tuberculosis. And that's something I can still picture that. I couldn't have been more than about 5 or 6 years old. But there's... I know that surgeons at the UW have helped out in that whole field of tuberculosis.
So that is, thankfully, at least in this country, pretty much managed. And tuberculosis is rare, except for dense urban situations, we do encounter tuberculosis in our global health work in developing countries around the world. But those advances from general anesthesia away from ether, safety went up to current techniques in regional anesthesia, where many operations, including hip replacements, knee replacements, can be done with a regional anesthesia, injection and sedation without taking the risk of putting someone to sleep, have increased the efficacy, decreased the cost, and improved the outcomes of the surgical procedures that we do. And then with the extension of that, the ability not only from anesthesia, but to support the circulatory system and circulation with bypass pumps for cardiac surgery, but probably more frequently and importantly to some degree for ill patients is ECMO, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a way to support pulmonary function, which is a reason why a lot of people survive the COVID crisis, because we could support their oxygenation with our ECMO teams that are hybrids of surgery and anesthesia teams for improving patient survival.
Oh. Our two guests today, Dr. Michael Benson, Dr. Rebecca Minter, surgeons at the UW Department of Surgery within the UW Medical School. It's great to have them with us today. If you have questions, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Two guests for you today, Dr. Rebecca Minter, professor and chair of the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a pancreatic obi-biliary, which is a really hard word to pronounce, and a surgeon in that area, a surgical education researcher and a surgical oncologist at UW Health. Dr. Michael Benz, professor in the Department of Surgery and a pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health. And I hope you'll join in, give a call. Lots of people online already, but there's a line open for you at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And we're kind of celebrating here, in my mind, I hope in yours as well, the 100th anniversary of the Department of Surgery at the UW-Madison, and taking a look at some of the many achievements from that department. And it's a pleasure for me to talk with him. Dave is on Highway 10 in the car, I'm betting. Dave, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a retired anesthesiologist. I tell my friends I'm still on the waiting list at UW Medical School. I went to Medical College of Wisconsin.
Okay.
I'm a retired cardiac anesthetist. My question for you is, the recent ruling that came down on one of the Medicare Advantage plans was to limit reimbursement for anesthesia based on the length of time of the procedure. And I have had 45 years of experience knowing what it's like, that some surgeons are quick and efficient, others are quick and maybe not so good, and others are slow to the heck. Is this going to domino in terms of billing issues? Because it's going to create a balanced bill problem for a patient if the insurance company only pays for a specific time. And, of course, we can't just turn the juice off in the middle of the case. So I'm curious about your opinion. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
So obviously it's a very timely topic amidst what's happening with the tragedy of the CEO of United Healthcare being murdered. This was a topic that has just recently come up. It was with the Anthem product and out of New York. And fortunately that has been quickly walked back. You're exactly right. They say, you know, whenever you ask a surgeon how long the case is going to take, double it, because we're always very optimistic about how quickly we will operate. And it's ridiculous, of course, that you would not support a patient's entire anesthesia bill for the procedure. So it's my understanding that fortunately it's been walked back, but I think it's just a symptom of the broader issue we're seeing in our country, where we have increased denials and increased just layers of bureaucracy that we have to walk through to try to get the care our patients need. And our payers are, of course, also trying to take care of their patients and do the best that they can for them. But it does seem like it's a process that needs an overhaul all the way around to make it easier and cost effective for patients to get the right care.
Yeah. Sean in Mineral Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was driving in to work today, and I'm only doing that because Dr. Bentz was one of the surgeons that was able to help get me back into health and able to do it. And I'm driving and I hear his voice, and, you know, I just reminded at how much hard work he and the entire UW system put in with me. I can only imagine what they've done for so many other people, and I'm truly grateful to him and the entire system.
Sean, thank you for calling. Dr. Bentz, I hope you get to hear that once in a while, more often.
Well, Sean, thank you. I'm glad you're well. Most importantly, I'm glad we were able to deliver what you needed, both as a surgeon, but more importantly, as a health system, which is really the delivery of healthcare now is through systems. Back to the original question, I would say this anesthesia comment is one that should urge patients and physicians of all types to learn to become advocates for appropriate health care with insurers, with the government. I think that, the 30, 40, 50 years ago where care was delivered and there was not the same check and balance system, I think now we're in a different era. And, you know, for Sean to get the care that he needs and other patients, it's going to require both patients and physicians working together as advocates for their care, for their appropriate care, using data to deliver care in the most cost-efficient fashion possible. We know there are plenty of opportunities in our health system to do that, but having worked in developing countries my entire career, this is an excellent health system. We just need to make it more efficient, and I think that'll take us all working together.
Yeah, for sure. I want to take a look at a couple of other achievements as we move along here today before we go back to the phones. One that comes to mind is the care in cancer treatments. And there's something called Mohs surgery that I think is practice in a heck of a lot of places, and maybe Dr. Minery or
I'm going to give this one to Dr. Bentz.
Dr. Bentz, go.
UW surgery and our other colleagues and other departments have had significant impact over time on the care of cancer. One area that is international in nature is Mohs surgery. Dr. Fred Mohs initiated the concept of Mohs surgery, which is a way of removing skin cancer with a particular way to look at the specimen that's removed so that there's a high likelihood that the cancer is removed and the recurrence rates are less. It has, like most things in medicine, specific indications and things, but it is now used around the world for skin cancer treatment. As a part of Dr. Mohs' efforts here. It's interesting, when I first came here in 1999 and started learning about Dr. Mohs, when he started this concept of Mohs surgery, which, like much of medicine, evolved, he was felt to be a charlatan in the House of Medicine, working in our department, but he had a vision and an idea and passion and continued to refine this procedure, which is now the gold standard for skin cancer removal literally around the world. So that's one of the many impacts of our department and our institution on healthcare globally.
There was a lot of research, or has been a lot of research in your department on chemotherapeutic treatments for cancer as well. Has there not? Dr. Minner, maybe you can comment on that.
Sure. I know less about my predecessors in terms. There has been a lot of oncologic research done in terms of developing various therapies. Dr. Benz may know more in terms of the specifics, which predated my arrival here. And those individuals now also are in multiple other departments as well. I don't know, Mike, if you want to.
I would say very high level, you know, primary care cancer and secondary care cancer has been impacted by UW efforts. 5-FU as a therapy, which is used as a cancer therapeutic agent, was developed here. Many patients who have cancer are prone to clotting in the vessels in their body. Warfarin, which is an anticoagulant, which is developed here, has impacted people around the globe. Most people are surprised to know that warfarin stands for Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, which provided the funding, and that has had impact. Moving off of cancer to transplant, Dr. Folker Belzer, the chair of surgery in the 80s and the 90s, working with his lab PhD and colleague, Dr. Jim Southard, developed University of Wisconsin solution, UW solution, otherwise known as Belzer solution, which is used in solid organ transplantation like liver and kidney to preserve the length of time that the organ can be usable. And that is still today the most common and the most prominently used transplant solution in transplant services and institutions literally around the globe. A huge international impact for the transplant patient.
Well, yeah, and as I'm remembering this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think originally you had to do the transplant in within about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm. And that's correct, yeah. And the ability with the UW solution, which is what it's called around the world and still used today, extended the ability to preserve an organ for up to 20 hours. And Dr. Belzer actually flew to Europe to demonstrate that an organ could be preserved on a transatlantic flight and then implanted and function. And he had to win Tom Starzl over, because nobody in the field, going back to Dr. Benz's comments about Dr. Mohs, nobody believed that this could be possible. And Dr. Starzl at the time, who was at the University of Pittsburgh, was really an icon in transplant surgery, had to really become an advocate for this. So Dr. Belzer went to Pittsburgh and convinced Dr. Starzl, and really this is still the approach today for preserving organs around the world.
Pretty cool, and it's still called UW Solution, too.
It is. I
like that. John sent us an email. Ask your guests about the award recently given to Dr. Bing Rickers in San Francisco regarding the department's outstanding history.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk about that. So Dr. Rickers is one of my predecessors, and who really is incredibly beloved, and I think really following, you know, Dr. Belzer really put the University of Wisconsin Department of Surgery on the map in terms of really recruiting people from all over, building out all of the specialty areas in the department. Obviously, Dr. Belzer had tremendous impact as well, but huge focus on transplant. Dr. Rickers really built out the department. He recruited Dr. Benz as one great example of the individuals that he recruited, and still is quite involved and engaged with the department. He was recently recognized by the American College of Surgeons with their highest award, the Distinguished Service Award, and we were fortunate to all celebrate with him and his family there in San Francisco. And this is really in recognition not only of his contributions here at Wisconsin, but also, you know, nationally in the field of surgery, where he's had tremendous impact.
That's pretty cool. Really cool. Dr. Rebecca Minter and Dr. Michael Benz, our guests today from the Department of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, celebrating 100 years this year of service to Wisconsin, and as kind of learning today, not only Wisconsin, but pretty much around the world. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. What do you want to know about the surgery process, or maybe you've got a comment to share on the department? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Bentz, when was the pediatric surgery program established?
So that's a great Madison success story. Pediatric surgical care and pediatric medical care has been delivered here in Madison for decades and decades. In the late 90s, moving into the early 2000s, there was a dream that a freestanding children's hospital could be built in Madison, then not requiring children, requiring high-level care being transferred over, driving to Milwaukee. Then UW Hospital CEO Donna Sullenberger committed to that dream, was able to work through the health system, the university, the legislature, the community, in working with very generous donors to pull together what is now our incredibly beautiful and high-level American Family Children's Hospital, which opened in 2007. Before that, care was provided within the adult hospital, and care was good, but the space was not pediatric friendly, nor were we in any position to absorb the capacity growth that we saw when the doors opened. And it is an absolute build it and they will come storyline, where we have grown from standard surgical care across the subspecialties. We've recruited subspecialists to grow these out. And we've gone from what I would say basic surgical care of children to full transplantation, viscera, liver, bowel, and most recently started a pediatric cardiac transplant program that would have been unthinkable without a building and the recruitment that Drs. Rickers, Dr. Kent, and Dr. Minter have done to establish these very high-level programs, which also includes fetal surgery. So this has benefited the children from Madison, the children in the region, the children in the Midwest, and a group of children that come from a distance to get highly specialized care. So it's been a great story that could not have happened with each of those groups working together, particularly our highly generous donors who made this expensive proposition possible. The success can be measured by the care outcomes, by the number of children seen. And not too long after it opened, we had to add a couple additional stories on top to expand our capacity, but stay within the FAA guidelines for our helicopter transport limitations. And again, that went back to donors, the community, and the group of administration here with a vision to continue to expand at a high level the care of children in the upper Midwest, but particularly for our Madison children who deserved this level of care and access, as did their parents.
Yeah. And one of the things I note on that particular building is how inviting it is. And I've got to think that that has an impact on moms and dads and their children when they come.
If you haven't been in the lobby, it's beautifully designed to take some of the anxiety out of children and parents. And so that's nice on the surface, but really what counts is the level and the type of care delivered upstairs. The way the rooms have been designed that every parent can stay with their kid every night comfortably in a large room as part of their kind of journey of care. So there are multiple levels, both I would say on the side of design, but also more importantly on the side of function to continue to deliver this care.
I would just add as well that, you know, the Child Life program is outstanding and also has been heavily funded by really generous donors to, whether it's to the bringing the dogs in to see the kids and allowing them pet therapy and all sorts of things that really make it feel less scary for them.
Yeah. Holly and Abram, we'll go to you. Hi, Holly.
Hi, I do want to add to what I told your screener. The American Family Children's Hospital is a wonderful place for grandparents, too. My grandson had a surgery to repair a coarctation of his aorta at 5 days, and that he will be 12 in December, so we're very grateful for the care that he received in what was then, I think, a new program in 2012.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience, and the atrium there, or the lobby, is gorgeous. And my grandson had I have a three-year-old granddaughter, and so she would come, and she had her fourth birthday while my grandson was in the hospital, and the staff there helped us celebrate that fourth birthday for Scarlett. So it was a wonderful experience all around.
And you had a question relating to pancreatic cancer, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. I just wanted to ask Dr. Minter, and I understand there's a program on this that I will listen to, but what pancreatic cancer seems to happen, and it's always very late stage. Is there any screening that's being done before that people could participate in before the cancer gets that far? And I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly.
Well, I could talk about a whole hour just on this topic, but I will try to be brief. Yes, absolutely. We have a very unique and novel program here at UW. It's a program we started when I came in 2018. It opened in 2020, right as the pandemic hit. And it is for patients who have increased risk for pancreatic cancer. Population-based screening, as we do for, say, prostate cancer or breast cancer, hasn't worked for pancreatic cancer because even though it's on the rise, it's just not common enough, and we don't have a great test for it. However, patients who have incidental findings on their imaging that say they had appendicitis and we get some pictures of their pancreas, those patients get pulled in, we screen them. Patients who have a family history, we actively screen, and we're developing some really exciting new blood-based tests through Dr. Mohammed Murtaza, who leads our Center for Precision Medicine here at UW, and as a Department of Surgery faculty member, has developed some really exciting new tests that we hope will allow us to have better screening. But the UW Health Pancreatic Cancer Prevention Program is available for patients who have a family history or any increased risk for pancreatic cancer.
Thank you very much for that question. Susanna in Madison has a question as well. So let's go there. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have had a number of surgeries at UW, and I have to say that I've been 90% pleased. I mean, every time that I've had orthopedic surgery or I had Mohs surgery, it was wonderful. But there was one time that I had a small hernia surgery. And of course, they tell you all the things that could possibly happen. And a week later, I ended up with a terrible, terrible obstruction in my intestine. And we had actually gone to visit in Minneapolis and ended up being up there. I was in the hospital for over a week and had to stay another week till I could travel. And when I came back and went in to talk about it, I did not get a very positive reception. I was told, well, it rarely happens, and, you know, it's just how it is. My question is, how do you teach surgeons to really be sensitive to those kinds of things? Because I didn't want to make an issue about it, but it was concerning.
Okay. Thank you very much, Susanna, for calling. Well, I could probably have both of you comment one way or another. Dr. Benz, let's start with you.
Well, thank you for your call and appreciate your comments. As we, like every other organization, continues to work towards quality improvement, and we want every patient to have a perfect outcome and to feel like they're well treated. When we don't entirely deliver, it's really helpful for us to know, because that helps with our processes. In terms of individual surgeons, surgeons are not just technical machines, but they're also physicians. And we work at educating around that the hybrid of an excellent technician, but a really dedicated, patient-focused doctor is really the ideal hybrid of the care we want to deliver. So I do thank you for your comments because that helps us get better as we really think about ways we can continue to work to do better when we don't meet a goal.
Yeah, Dr. Minner, comment?
Sure. I would just add, I agree with everything that Dr. Bentz said, and we always want to know that, and we have processes to hear from patients, and we always try to respond. I think perhaps the other thing I would just share is to just know that as a surgeon, there's nothing more devastating than to have a patient not have the outcome that you hoped they would have. And unfortunately, we do sometimes have complications, and how people process that and handle that and communicate that is just as it is for all things related to being human. People have different ways they respond to that, and some are not always as empathetic as we would hope because they're sort of dealing with their own emotions around that complication. And so I'm sorry that that experience was not as we would hope it would be. But I would just share that as a surgeon, we also definitely feel terrible when things don't go as we hoped that they would.
Dr. Michael Bentz and Dr. Rebecca Minter, our guests from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, as we celebrate and talk about the 100th anniversary of the department. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the health history of surgery with our two guests today, Dr. Michael Bentz and Dr. Rebecca Minter from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, as the department celebrates 100 years of service to the U.S. And the UW, and of course the world as well. And speaking of that, Ralph and Hayward emailed us. We should celebrate the incredible talent and innovation at UW Surgery. Wonders, do either of you have a healthcare model from around the globe of how incredible surgical talent and ideas are being expressed as compared to our system?
So I'll comment and then I'll turn over to Dr. Bentz. We actually, within our department, we are one of the national leaders in the space global surgery. Dr. Gurma Tafera, who is one of our faculty members, actually leads what's called the American College of Surgeons HOPE program, which is really focused on global surgery and sustainability and developing bidirectional relationships with other parts of the world around surgical care delivery. So I think we always have a lot to learn bidirectionally. And I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Bentz, who's deeply involved in global surgery and has been for most of his career.
Yeah. Dr. Bentz?
Well, thank you for that question. Our department is recognized nationally, internationally for a commitment to global surgery. If you look back 30, 40 years, global surgery was a bunch of well-meaning surgeons traveling to a developing country, operating on a bunch of kids or adults without a system around, come home, no idea really what happened with those kids or adults afterwards. And now we've morphed into delivery of care, including preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative care. Our department has programs in Africa, Central America, South America, and Asia, where we are working towards capacity building. And that's the key part. These are longitudinal relationships, not trips where you parachute in, do a bunch of surgery and leave, but these are helping establish local systems in developing countries for the care of their children and adults. The foundation of that is the education of local surgeons. I have never operated in any of those places and not met surgeons who are really talented, motivated, who actually had enough hospital structure around them, but needed some confidence and perhaps some help with system building. What we're doing is working on capacity building. We don't need to be there year round, although that's a nice model, but it's somewhat impractical, where if we can help boost education both locally in country, but also through regular, you know, online video-based education, we can increase the amount of cases that are done in country when we're perhaps not there in all of our disciplines where we participate in this. The flip side is that we learn how to deliver care in a lower cost system, and you learn a lot about how to save materials, how not to waste, how to deliver care at a lower cost with less capital support, less instruments, less kind of the things that we get accustomed to and comfortable here don't necessarily add value and add cost. So as we all look at trying to decrease the cost of medicine, the experience of residents, fellows, medical students, and attending surgeons donating their time, that they're volunteering their time, not getting paid for this, to deliver education turns out to be a win-win in both directions in these longitudinal partnerships, which inevitably evolve into longitudinal friendships.
And I would just add one thing, which is that when we were in the throes of the pandemic and we had all of these supply chain issues, it was our Dr. Tefera, Dr. Bentz, our global surgeons who helped us think about how we could create the resources we need to take care of patients, because we were in a low resource setting at that point during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this whole business of education, and just back here, is, you know, this is obviously educating those surgeons. It's a teaching place. And how's it evolved, or what are you doing now that maybe you didn't do before, Dr. Minner?
So surgical education is my sort of area of scholarship focus. And I remember vividly being a medical student, watching these residents operate with the attendings and thinking, how in the world, you know, in only 5 years will I be able to put that patient back together who suffered from a gunshot wound or something else? And I will just tell you that it's an amazing process, and the process works. I will say that we're really focused on innovation. It is that, as Dr. Bentz alluded to earlier, there's so much more to learn now, so many more technologies. You asked about what surgery, it is blurry. We do things with scopes and robots, and it's a lot more complicated, and the medical side of what we need to learn is much more complicated. So really our focus now is on how do we make sure that the product that we turn out stays as excellent as it has always been, but also prepares our surgeons for all the things that they need to know and doesn't make training 20 years instead of 10.
Yeah.
It's already too long. So we've really focused, and UW is a national leader, really leading the way in a new initiative that the American Board of Surgery is moving forward, which is really a focus, and this will sound silly because of course we've always worried about competency-based training, but really a focus away from time-based training to really being intentional around making sure that our graduates have all the skills they need to go into the world to continue to learn, as you highlighted. It's a continuous process. And so UW is a leader in that space of developing these new frameworks for training surgeons to make sure that they have the skills they need when they enter practice.
Yeah. Well, we got an email from Jim, and Jim has worked with both of you as a volunteer for a charitable organization. And his observation is, you will never find two more intelligent and kind individuals as these two professionals. And that's kind of a nice way to end. And I want to thank you both for all your work over the years, and for helping make the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health the great institution it is. It's been a pleasure for me to talk with you, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you both so much. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Michael Bentz, pediatric plastic and reconstructive surgeon at UW Health, and Dr. Rebecca Minter, surgeon and a surgical education researcher and a surgical oncologist at UW Health. It's great to have an organization like this right here in our state of Wisconsin, and a pleasure for me to talk with them, and I hope you learned a little too along the way. And you're probably going to learn more about healthy sleep next. At least I could use a little more sleep and a little more healthy sleep myself, so I've got all kinds of questions for our next guest. I'm Larry Mehler. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Today, for the next hour, we're going to be talking about what healthy sleep looks like and how you can get it. And with us today, Dr. Rick Blackburn. Dr. Blackburn is a behavioral health sleep medicine director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota. Dr. Blackburn is a licensed psychologist, board certified in behavioral sleep medicine. And great to have him with us today. And as we talk about sleep, of course, want to hear from you. How does the quality of sleep you get at night affect your daily life? Give us the strategies you use to wind down at night. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we certainly love to hear from you and your experiences. Dr. Rick Blackburn, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start simply. Why do people need sleep?
Well, that's not really a simple question. And the truth is, we really don't know fully why we sleep. We have research showing that sleep is restorative when we're in the deepest stages of sleep, called slow wave sleep. Our body releases human growth hormone that helps restore cells, helps with growth in children, and restores hair and nails. It does provide minimal energy conservation, but we really only save about 370 calories by sleeping. We know sleep helps regulate our immune system. It helps with memory consolidation, and it activates the lymphatic system. And the lymphatic system is really a relatively new discovery, but basically when we're in slow-wave sleep, our ventricles in our brain enlarge, and it pulls the spinal fluid up into the brain. And then when we leave slow-wave sleep, it pushes it down, and they found that it's filled with beta amyloid, which are parts that causes the plaques and tangles in Alzheimer's disease. So sleep does clean our brain out.
Wow. And what about the day-to-day behavior? You know, if you're deprived of sleep, what do you see in your research relating to this? How it affects our behavior?
Yeah, well, it really affects our performance and our vigilance or ability to pay attention to things. We know that if people sleep after learning something, like a high school student or a college student, the memory is more likely to be remembered. We know that in sleep, our memory consolidates with other memories, making it more accessible. But what most people will notice is that they have a harder time focusing. They have less attention that they can direct at specific things, and that can lead to performance impairments, but also lead to workplace accidents.
Oh. So what controls when and how you sleep?
Okay. So sleep is actually governed by two forces that oppose each other. One is called process S, or sleep drive. But essentially, when we're awake, our brain is accumulating chemicals that make us feel increasingly sleepy. Most adults need to be awake about 16 consecutive hours to have enough pressure to sleep through the night, but some people need to be awake a little bit longer. Now, if the sleep pressure was the only thing governing sleep, we'd be a lot like a newborn. We'd be awake for a couple hours, sleep for a while, wake up again, and all day long we'd have this on-again, off-again wakefulness. So our body has a circadian alerting signal, and basically when you open your eyes in the morning, the light turns on this system and it starts a new 24-hour cycle. But the time that you get up has to be fairly constant. This alerting signal runs off the same chemicals that stress, fear, and anxiety run on, and we think that that actually was an adaptive function. I mean, if you were being chased by a pack of wolves, you wouldn't want to suddenly fall asleep. But this alerting signal peaks for most adults around 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and then it starts to drop off. And then sleep pressure takes over, and that's what pulls us into sleep.
So I guess, how do you tell for sure if you're not getting enough sleep? I guess attention, the things that you've described probably come to the fore.
Yeah. So sleep need varies by individual and by age. So most adults need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night. Some need a little bit more, some need a little bit less. But in general, we're awake about two-thirds of a 24-hour period and sleep for a third. However, you should be in the age range or the amount of sleep for your age range that's appropriate. But then the second side of it is that you should feel well rested during the day. And so some people have other sleep disorders or they're on medications that may interfere with feeling well rested during the day. But in general, your sleep should be enough for you to feel refreshed and able to go about your daily activities.
You might be waking up in the middle of the night, let's say every night at 3 or something in the morning. What are some reasons that this happens?
Well, waking up at 3 a.m. is probably very familiar to people who are horror movie buffs. because all bad things happen at 3 a.m. in horror movies. And what's true is, for eons, people would wake up between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and before we could explain it as a biological function, they said there were evil spirits out doing mischievous things, and they dubbed it the witching or the voodoo hour. The truth is that when we fall asleep, our body temperature drops throughout the night, which pulls us deeper into sleep. And then around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning for most people, the body temperature starts to rise. And whenever body temperature starts to tick upward, we tend to wake up. Think about that fitful sleep you have when you're running a temperature. The other thing that happens around that time is your body starts releasing cortisol to prepare you for waking up. So if you wake up in that 3 to 4 hour range and you maybe go to the bathroom and then go back to sleep, that's not a problem. But it's when you wake up and then you can't get back to sleep that can really disrupt your day.
Yeah, why does that happen? I mean, I've had that happen to me many times over my life. You wake up at midnight or 1 in the morning or whatever, and then you go back, and most times I go right back to sleep. I can go back to sleep in a few minutes, but there are times when I might be up for another hour.
Yeah. And so sleep is really complex. You know, if you wake up and your mind is thinking about something or if you're worrying about something, that can keep you up. The other thing is that we get older, our clock tends to shift earlier so that we prefer to fall asleep earlier and wake up earlier. And that's just a normal part of aging. But it can get to where people, no matter what time they go to sleep, they're going to wake up at that time and not get back to sleep. And that can be a sign of a sleep disorder.
Okay. And speaking of that, Martin and Ripon emailed us. Martin would like to point out the importance of having an overnight sleep test. And that may relate to what you were just sort of getting at there. Martin had one in 2018. Which disclosed that Martin did not have sleep apnea, but that Martin's heart rate was slowing down dramatically during sleep. And this problem was then addressed successfully, but Martin might never have known of the problem until it was too late without the sleep test.
Right. And sleep tests get to be kind of a difficult thing now. So it's called a polysomnogram. And basically, you have to meet certain criteria to qualify for a sleep study like Martin had. And there's lots of things like ruling out sleep apnea or cardiac issues or abnormal behaviors during the night that justify it. But it's not something that your average person can just say, I want a sleep study to see what's going on. There has to be a problem first.
Yeah. How is insomnia treated these days?
So, unfortunately, insomnia is still treated the way it usually has been in most cases, which is you go to your doctor, they give you a handout on sleep hygiene, and maybe a medication for a sleeping pill. However, that's not the recommended treatment for adult insomnia. So in 2005, the National Institutes of Health declared that cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, should be the first-line treatment for adult insomnia. In 2016, the American College of Physicians, which is the doctor group your primary care provider probably belongs to, reviewed all the treatments for insomnia, including medicines, homeopathic, naturalistic remedies, over-the-counters, and they found that CBTI was the safest, most effective, and most durable treatment for insomnia, and they recommended, too, that it be the first-line treatment. The problem is there aren't a lot of us out there treating insomnia with CBTI. So even though it's the recommended treatment, there just aren't enough providers available.
And so CBTI, again, to make that more plain, is?
So basically what we do is we manipulate the psychological, physiological elements that control sleep. So we use controlled sleep deprivation to first get the person to fall asleep quickly and stay asleep. And then once they're able to sleep efficiently, then we gradually expand the opportunity for sleep until they're getting the sleep they need that's appropriate for their age and they feel well rested during the day.
Cool. Okay, Dr. Rick Blackburn, our guest today, Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist as well. It's great to have him with us. And I hope you'll join in with your questions about sleep. Are you getting enough sleep? Do you have problems with it? Have you overcome those problems? Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about sleep now, the importance of getting a good night's sleep, and what if you're not, how can you get it? With our guest, Dr. Rick Blackburn, lots of experience in this area he has. He is the Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Consulting in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist. It's great to have him with us. I know we have lots of callers online, and we have some emails as well. Bobby emailed us, magnesium an hour before bed. After years of bad sleep, it has Bobby sleeping 6 or 7 hours straight. So magnesium.
Yeah, magnesium can be beneficial for sleep. It has a somewhat soothing, relaxing quality. It helps certain vitamins and minerals get into your system. When combined with a little calcium, it can help the calcium absorb. It is, for most people, relatively benign. Does it have a lot of power to help sleep? Not according to research, but then you hear cases like Bobby, who says it made a world of difference, and that's just because sleep is unique in every individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Felix in Reedstown, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Felix.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Are you able to hear me?
Yes. You coming in loud and clear.
Sounds good. Well, real quick, the elevator speech is I've got severe PTSD, and as part of that, I've got dissociative sleep eating, where I wake up in the middle of the night, and because I ignore my body's interoceptive signals during the day, I don't see myself as eating food in a conscious state, either going into sleep or between sleep. I'm doing complicated food activities like using knives and eating cheese because it's Wisconsin. But the doctors think that the severity of the PTSD is related to at least the sleep eating, and that there's not a lot of awareness around how dissociative impacts from PTSD at least can relate to sleep. And yet this is not technically a sleep disorder, in my understanding, because of it being related primarily to the mental health, and I wanted to spread some awareness around that.
Oh, Felix, thanks for calling. Comments on that, Dr. Blackburn?
Yeah, so Felix, it is a sleep disorder. It's called sleep-relating eating disorder. And P- people with PTSD do have more of it, and it can happen in a dissociative state. Sometimes medications that we're taking to help with sleep or to help with our PTSD can also cause us to do things that we don't remember. They can use low-dose clonazepam to help you not act out your or eat while you're sleeping. But there's also environmental controls, like putting a lock on the refrigerator. The part with dangerous utensils is concerning because people can and have hurt themselves. And so, again, it might be environmental controls, like putting child locks on the knife cupboard, just so that there's one more thing that intervenes between you and potentially hurting yourself. But if it does get severe, you can go see a sleep physician, and there are some treatments out there that can help.
All right. Felix, thank you for calling. Barbara in Fort Atkinson, your turn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how long should it take a person to go to sleep after they're in the bed, and what is a definition of insomnia?
Okay. So for most people, it usually takes between 10 and 30 minutes to fall asleep. You know, when we do sleep therapy, we're aiming for around 20 minutes, but definitionally, it's not insomnia if you're falling asleep in less than 30 minutes. How quickly you fall asleep can be signs of other problems, though. So if you're falling asleep the minute your head hits the pillow, that's either a sign of severe sleep deprivation, or you might have a disorder like obstructive sleep apnea, where your body is so tired it just shuts down. And the reason that's concerning is because that can happen during the day, during quiet moments, like when you're at a stoplight driving, or you're sitting in a boring meeting at work. But normally, a normal time to fall asleep is between 10 and 30 minutes. The definition of insomnia is that you either have difficulties falling asleep, staying asleep, or you wake up too early and can't get back to sleep, or some combination of them, and it causes daytime impairment and distress. And it's not due to another sleep disorder or a medication or something like that. It needs to occur at least 3 days a week for more than 3 months.
All right. There you go, Barbara. Thank you very much for calling. Dustin in Central Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Dustin.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Excuse me.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
So I got clean from opiates in January 16th, 2016. Since then, I have been, I guess, up and down on good sleep. And my question would be where to start, I guess, in general. So I have, for myself, gotten into a good rhythm where I do go to sleep at the same time every night. I tend to wake up at the same time every morning. But the issues that I'm having are exactly what you were just speaking of, as where about 1, 2 o'clock I tend to wake up, just use the restroom, and I cannot fall back asleep. And again, I don't know if that goes hand-in-hand with the drug addiction that was, you know, for 15-plus years, and typically it would just knock myself out. So it took a long time to get used to sleeping, you know, without the drugs. I know that's pretty broad, but I'm going to leave it there and let you go and listen to your answer.
All right. Thanks, Dustin.
Before you go, Dustin, how old are you?
Yeah. I'm 38.
38. Okay. So sleep disorders are actually many times a precursor to an addictive disorder. So people are self-medicating using a drug like opiates to help them get to sleep. When they're on the medications, it messes with sleep. The opiates can cause central sleep apnea, where the brain just doesn't get the signal to breathe. And then once you enter into recovery, sleep generally improves, but for some people it doesn't, or it's slow to improve. And we know that poor sleep is often a relapse trigger. So if I were you and you're having that early morning awakening, I would come and see a sleep specialist like myself or one of the other ones at Nystrom's or somewhere near you, because they can treat that using cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And that has shown to be effective for people who are in recovery.
Oh, Dustin, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You have, I think, six ways, or maybe we could call them rules, to help people improve their sleep. What are they?
So they're formally called the six rules of stimulus control. And so in 1972, it was discovered by a researcher in Arizona. And there are six rules that help cement our circadian clocks and control our sleep pressure. And for most people, if they follow these six rules, within a couple months, they'll start sleeping better. If they don't, then that's a sign they should see a sleep specialist. So the first rule is to get up at the same time every day. The time that we wake up controls the speed of our clock, and it resets it for a 24-hour period, because not everyone's clock runs 24 hours. So if you get up at various times of the day or sleep in by a couple hours, you can get what's called social jet lag, which is essentially like jet lag, only you're not going someplace different. We want the bed to be used for sleeping and intimacy only. Don't read, watch TV, or do other things in bed. What that's doing is it's training your mind to be awake and alert while you're in bed. When you get into bed, the bed should be a signal that it's time for sleep and not some other activities. The third rule is that anytime you're awake for 20 minutes or longer, get up and do something enjoyable but not too stimulating. Don't lie awake in bed. When you lie awake in bed, your brain gets bored. The part of the brain that stays online most of the night is the part that scans our environment for threats. So our thoughts often become more active and they tend to be more anxiety driven. And we know that if people get up, they might be up longer that night, but they're less likely to do that in future nights, provided they follow the other rules of this. Second rule, or fourth rule, is don't worry, plan, or ruminate in bed. If your mind is active, get up and go do something distracting until you feel sleepy. Don't nap during the day unless you're sick and need the rest to recover, or if you have to take a brief nap to drive or operate machinery safely. But when we started, I said that sleep pressure builds up steadily throughout the day, and so if you take a nap, it bleeds off that sleep pressure, which then makes it more difficult for you to sleep at night. And insomniacs often get stuck in this vicious cycle where they sleep poorly at night, so they nap during the day, but that nap then makes them more likely to sleep poorly at night. And the final rule is go to bed only when sleepy, but not before your normal bedtime. So I noted that when you get out of bed during the middle of the night because your mind is active or you're awake for long periods of time, stay up until you feel sleepy. And then this last rule says go to bed when you're sleepy. But people often make the mistake of assuming that sleepy is synonymous with tired, fatigued, exhausted, and it's not. Tired, fatigued, and exhausted are energy states. It's that low motivation, that feeling unwell, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're sleepy. Sleepy is when you're starting to nod off. And so what happens is people who have sleep problems will often say, I went to bed because I was so tired and exhausted. And I'll ask them, but were you sleepy? And they'll say, no, I was wide awake and alert. So then you need to stay up until you feel sleepy.
Interesting point. Six points there. Those rules make really good sense as you explained it.
Right. Well, and the thing about sleep is it's logical and it follows rules. The truth is we don't teach people the logic of sleep or the rules of sleep, and some of those rules are counterintuitive. So if you have insomnia, you should spend less time in bed, but intuitively think we should spend more time in bed so we have more opportunity to catch sleep. So the rules do work, and they do follow the rules of sleeping. They just not might not make sense to us in the moment.
Yeah. Nancy in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about women's health and menopause because hot flashes are a terrible interrupter of sleep, and they can lead to brain fog. And I've noticed that women tend to think that, we just have to accept that, and we're all just going to walk around, you know, with a little bit of brain fog. And I experienced that myself, and I talked to my doctor and got on hormone replacement therapy, and the hot flashes went away, and there went my sleep interruption. And I have no more problems with that middle of the night insomnia.
That's wonderful to hear, Nancy. And the truth is, women struggle with sleep at different points throughout their lifespan. In general, women are 2 times more likely than men to have insomnia. But it also changes with their menstrual cycle. So even within a month, their sleep can fluctuate. They go through radical changes when they're pregnant. And when they get to that peri or postmenopausal state, their sleep tends to get even worse. One of the other things that happen is men are 4 times more likely than women to have sleep apnea until menopause, and then it's a 1-to-1 ratio. So there are things you can do environmentally. You can wear moisture-wicking clothes, cool the room, but exactly what you said is a good route to explore. So hormone replacement therapy does work, and for most women it can help. There are some risks involved in hormone replacement therapy, especially with certain types of cancer, but that is a discussion you should have with your doctor, and if it's appropriate, it's worth giving it a try, because for you, it sounds like it was the miracle you were looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Allie in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Allie.
Hi. So I was calling because I'm wondering, when you have a newborn or a baby, how can we make sure that we are getting good sleep hygiene or getting enough sleep?
Yeah, and that's a challenge because newborns are polyphasic, which means they don't really have a rhythm to their sleep yet, so they're awake and asleep at different times, and it often conflicts with ours. We know that poor sleep post-delivery increases the risk of postpartum depression and other mental health disorders, and so it's really difficult, and I think this is one of those cases where if you have a partner, you should really have a talk with the partner about how to manage this. So when my wife and I had newborns, we would take turns at night. I would get up and change the diaper. When the baby was breastfeeding, I'd bring it to her, and then I'd put it back in the crib. And once the baby got to a bottle and wasn't breastfeeding, then we did alternate nights so that at least every other night the person was getting good sleep. It is a challenging period, and unfortunately in our society, the bulk of newborn care still falls on the women. And that's where if you have a partner or a friend or someone who can give you a break, it can make a world of difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. DJ in Madison, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
For the program. I wanted to talk about cat naps, since it has not been mentioned, and I know it has a lot to do with if you get too much, it interferes with your sleep, especially if you're a night owl like me. You get a little bit too much, and you're tugging on your eyelids at 2:30 in the morning.
Right. So, go ahead, Larry.
No, go ahead, Dr. Blackburn.
So naps have always been confusing to people because the rule is if you have problems sleeping at night, you should not nap because that bleeds off the sleep pressure and makes the next night more difficult. If you sleep okay at night, but you're still tired during the day because you don't have the opportunity to get enough sleep, naps can be very beneficial. And in fact, cultures across the world have incorporated this into their practices. Mediterranean and Mexican cultures have the siesta. British take short naps called kips, and they caffeinate at tea time. The Japanese actually have nap pods built into their work headquarters. So what you call a cat nap, we call a power nap, and basically it's 20 to 30 minutes that you sleep to bleed off sleep pressure so you can function well during the day and still not disrupt your sleep at night. Ideally, that power nap would take place at least 10 hours before your bedtime so that sleep pressure can build up again. But again, if you're operating heavy machinery, driving, or doing something that requires a lot of sustained attention, a cat nap can be very beneficial.
Yeah. DJ, thank you very much for calling. Bill in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good afternoon. Great program. I find sleep fascinating. It's a fascinating component. And I remember doing a speech in college days where I presented the fact that we sleep one third of our lives. And at that time, I was, 21 years old and thought, my gosh, I slept 7 years of my life already. And that to wrap my head around that just was a fascinating thing to me and really made me look at sleep in a different way. A couple suggestions I have. I love your sleep rules, and I love the concept of sleep pressure because I've never thought of it that way. A couple things that have worked for me, and I slept pretty good most of my adult life except for before hip surgery and getting hips replaced. I was in a lot of pain, and I had a lot of more compassion for people who have issues sleeping because, holy cow, to wake up in the morning after a night of pain and not sleeping well was not pleasant. A few things I found that have been very, very helpful, no eating or drinking alcohol late into the night. And when I say no eating, I don't mean like a couple cookies at 8 o'clock. I'm talking about a heavy meal. And not drinking wine to 10 o'clock at night. Very, very important to me. Probably one of the most important is adequate exercise, especially being outdoors during the day as much as possible. To me, that gives the most sleep pressure, really makes that pressure go very high for me personally. Another thing is really avoiding, again, going to your stimulation control that you mentioned, absolutely or minimal screen time, anything electronic in the last couple hours before bed. And then finally, what I found to be extremely helpful is in that wind down period where you're maybe shutting your computer down and setting the thermostats and brushing your teeth is just very mindful, slow, deep, quiet breathing. And I find most nights I'm asleep between 5 and 15 minutes after I hit the bed if I've incorporated those things, as well as some of the other things you mentioned in your six rules of sleep too. But
yeah, those are all excellent suggestions, Bill. The one thing that's starting to be rethought about is the impact of screens on our sleep. So initially we thought light in itself was bad, and then we found that blue and green spectrum of lights were more harmful than other forms of light. And some of the research coming out now says that that might not be as big of a deal as we thought it was. The big thing is that people are often on their phones a lot, and they sacrifice sleep so that they can stay on their screens. But the rest of those things about cutting down on alcohol, not eating a heavy meal before you go to bed, and even reducing caffeine during the day are all excellent suggestions. It sounds, Bill, like you're on the right track and you found some good skills.
Yeah, it sure does. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Some really good skills there. Karen in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you? I just wondered, I have REM sleep disorder. It was a long time ago, and I'm still taking Klonopin for it. I'm 70 now, and I just wondered, am I more at risk from having been diagnosed with REM sleep disorder to get, like, dementia or Parkinson's or something like that? Or is it more that I want to get off these pills so I don't get dementia?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about REM sleep disorder. When we go into REM sleep, which is the stage where we dream, our body develops what's called muscle atonia, where essentially our brain disconnects itself from your muscles so that you don't act out your dreams. Some people develop a disorder where they do act out their dreams. It's much more common in men, and it tends to start after age 50. And the questions Karen were asking are exactly the concerns that we have, because within 10 to 12 years of developing REM behavior disorder, 90% of people go on to develop a neurodegenerative disorder like Parkinson's or Lewy body dementia. How long ago did you say you were diagnosed, Karen?
I'm 70 now, and I was probably in my 40s.
Okay.
Okay. So you might not be at high risk for that because typically the changes happen. And again, it's not 100%. It's much higher in men than in women. Now, your concern about the clonazepam, we used to believe that medications in that class would cause an increased risk of dementia. And what's starting to be rethought now is that people with dementia are more likely to be on clonazepam. So we've been looking at it as this medication causes dementia, and now we're looking at they're correlated, but it's not causal.
Ah.
The big risk with medications like clonazepam are that it affects balance and it increases the risks of falls, which for someone in their 70s increases the risk for hip fractures and other injuries.
Karen,
you can also. Yeah. Oh, one other thing, Karen, is you can talk to your doctor because there is some evidence out there that high doses of melatonin are as effective as clonazepam. And so that would be something to discuss with a sleep specialist. What I would tell you is make sure you don't go cold turkey off clonazepam. Make sure you follow your doctor's instructions because suddenly stopping that can cause some problems.
Okay. Karen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Rick Blackburn, our guest, Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine Director at Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, a licensed psychologist. Great to have him with us today. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in as we talk sleep with him. The number, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking sleep today with our guest, Dr. Rick Blackburn of Nystrom and Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, licensed psychologist and the director of Behavioral Health Sleep Medicine. Great to have him with us today. I want to go back to sleep for a minute because our producer, Clara, had heard that having certain dreams indicate you're subconsciously stressed out. For example, if you're maybe dreaming about losing your teeth, you're stressed. Any truth to that? As a sleep medicine director, do you study your patients' dreams?
No. So back in the 1950s, when they discovered REM sleep, it pretty much threw out most of the psychoanalytic approach to dream interpretation. What we do know is that our dreams tend to be filled with content that have to do with our predominant emotion during the day. So like if you're going back to school and you have that back to school dream of not knowing where your classes are and it's final days and maybe you're not wearing clothing, it's a sign of anxiety. So in REM sleep, our body takes memories and it basically lessens the strength of the emotional tone to that memory. So it's like overnight therapy. Your mother was right. If something's upsetting you, sleep on it, you'll probably feel better in the morning. So yes, if you're having anxiety-provoking dreams, it's probably because you're feeling more anxious, but not necessarily so.
Angela in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Angela.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. What I'm calling about is to just talk about my personal experience with how my cats can disrupt my sleep during the night, and that what I learned I had to do was to close the bedroom door and put boxes and other things in front of it to prevent them from knocking on the door and waking me up, but mainly just to prevent them from sleeping with me. Many years ago, when I was feeling horrible and I had a lot of pain and stuff, and I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which I didn't want to believe I had, and at that point, I ended up not allowing my cats to sleep with me, and all my symptoms went away, and I was feeling better again. I was sleeping through the night. So now I realize I have to start doing the same with my new cats, and just wanted to pass that along for other people who might have problems with animals disrupting their sleep.
Yeah. Angela, yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
And it's not just animals. I mean, it can also be bed partners. So a few years ago, they published a statistic that 43% of partners don't sleep in the same bed because one sleep disrupts the other's sleep. And they called it a sleep divorce, and it's perfectly normal, and it doesn't affect the stability or the strength of the relationship. But I think what Angela is suggesting is that there are things within your environment that can disrupt your sleep. For her, it was cats. And if it's something that's happening regularly, you need to work to find a solution for that.
Makes a very good sense. A listener called, couldn't stay with us, but and we've kind of addressed this a little bit, but what are your comments about reading in bed? And I'll go along with that listener. I have, in the course of a year, I'll read at least 50 books for this radio show. And I've often sat in bed and read myself. And I can usually fall asleep but after reading a chapter or two. But what are your comments on reading in bed?
So sleep is unique, right? If you don't have insomnia, reading in bed might not be a bad thing. When people come in for treatment for, like, insomnia, we apply the rules rigidly and we take away everything that can disrupt sleep. And then after their sleep improves, then we can experiment with adding things back in bed. But people are different. I had a patient that we took away her reading in bed and suddenly it was taking her an hour or longer to fall asleep. And she said, you know, if I could just read in bed, I'd fall asleep within 5 minutes. So I said, let's test it and see what the data shows. And she was right. So these rules are applied to everyone. But just like everything, there are unique exceptions in every person. So if you're having problems sleeping at night, getting rid of activities in bed is a good idea. If not, it might be okay.
All right. V from Kenosha emailed us, 36-year-old male takes 50 milligrams of trazodone each night for the last 6 months and has no issue falling asleep within 30 minutes, usually has only a little grogginess in the morning. V typically goes to sleep around 9 p.m. and wakes at 5, usually becomes very tired around 4 p.m. Is this a result of the trazodone or the drug? Is this a drug that V can use long-term with little issues down the road, or something V should try to eventually work out of sleep's routine?
So trazodone is an old sedating antidepressant, and it's been around for a long, long time. It's not used for depression anymore because the doses that were needed for it to have an antidepressant effect, people couldn't stay awake. So it's now one of the most commonly prescribed sleep medications, and it's what doctors call a dirty medication because it's not very selective in what receptor sites in the brain it attaches to. It has a long half-life, so there's often that morning kind of hangover effect. But I think what V is talking about is when we talked about that alerting signal that helps us stay awake during the day, for people typically between noon and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that signal weakens a little bit. So it's normal for us to get a little bit sleepy in the afternoon. And if you elevate your body temperature by getting a little exercise or light, it can minimize that. But 50 milligrams of trazodone is not likely causing his sedation at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
We just went through daylight savings time. We fell back in the fall here. And what do you know about the time change and how it affects the way we sleep? And I just personally, I can tell you, it takes me weeks to get over this stupid fall back. I'm not a problem. It's not a problem in the spring for a day, only a day or two. But in the evening, in the fall, it is a problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, the sleep world has been trying to get rid of daylight savings time for years, and it comes up in Congress almost every session and then doesn't happen. But it does disrupt. So we know that when we spring ahead in the spring, that the day after that, there's the greatest number of car accidents and heart attacks and strokes, and it's because of the effect it has on our body. Now, some people like the fall, unlike Larry, because their body clocks tend to be slower and they tend to be night owls, so it more fits in with their circadian rhythm. For those of us who are early birds, we like the one in the spring because now we can go to bed at what seems to be a more reasonable time and we wake up when we're normally waking up. But what we do know is that it has a huge effect. It does take time to adjust to it. And ideally, we would get rid of it. But that hasn't happened yet. But my hope is that it will soon.
Oh, I mean, me too. It just drives me crazy how long it takes me to get over this. Judge called, couldn't stay with us, wondering if there's any news or research about the Inspire sleep system. It's a surgical implant. It treats obstructive sleep apnea by stimulating the throat muscles to keep the airway open while sleeping. Mayo Clinic, yes. I think, has done some work on it.
Yep. So Inspire is actually a Minnesota company. And it is basically they insert a pacemaker-like device in your right upper chest. There's a wire that goes down to your diaphragm or your breathing muscle, and then another wire goes up and attaches to the hypoglossal muscle, which is the one that controls your tongue. When the sensor on your diaphragm senses that you're struggling to breathe, it applies an electrical current that makes your tongue go forward a little bit so it opens up your airway. It's sort of akin to doing the jaw thrust in CPR. It is very effective. You do have to jump through some hoops. Most insurances require that you fail on CPAP or BiPAP before. And then you go in and they'll put you out with propofol, like when you go in for a surgical procedure, and they want to make sure that the apnea is caused by the tongue going back into the throat. If it is, then you can get it. I've only had two patients who have had it, and they both love it. Because basically they turn it on when they get into bed with a magnet, they turn it off in the morning, and they don't have to wear a CPAP or a machine.
Yeah, those the machines are, I had one for a while myself, but then I lost about 30 pounds, and it went away. I tested again, and it was, I passed. I didn't have it anymore. But they are very, to me, I had an awful time trying to adjust to those, and it inspired me to lose the weight.
Yeah. And you know, I have a CPAP too, and I love it. I don't even take a nap without it, but it does take adjustment getting to it. So like Larry, you said that we're based out of New Brighton. We're actually in five states with over 60 clinics, and we just opened up 9 in Wisconsin. So if you're having problems with sleep or you're having problems getting used to CPAP, we can help you get there.
I tell you what, a lot of people might be looking you up there, Rick. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Boy, it flew by, and we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually the way it is on the show. Thank you again, and I hope we can do this again. Look forward to another visit with you.
I would love to. Thank you for the invite today. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Rick Blackburn, a behavioral health sleep medicine director at Nystrom & Associates Counseling in New Brighton, Minnesota, a licensed psychologist. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get Wisconsin State Park recommendations from a park ranger. And we'll also look at how the UW Extension is helping out farmers in the state. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Really appreciate your time spent listening with us, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.